Straight Talk Wireless has now rolled out 5G coverage nationwide with no contract, all on America's best networks. Straight Talk Wireless, no contract, no compromise. Available at Walmart and Walmart.com. 5G capable device required. Actual availability, coverage, and speed may vary. The getaway van wasn't where it was supposed to be. A prison guard had called for one. It needed to be at the Sally Port entrance of the Mecklenburg Correctional Center. A group of men in riot gear were carrying a stretcher with a blanket over it. One of them was spraying it with a fire extinguisher. They were saying they had found a bomb inside death row, and they needed the van to get the device as far away from the prison as possible before it detonated. The men in riot gear were not guards. They were death row inmates in disguise. That wasn't a bomb underneath the blanket. It was a television set they had stolen from C-Pod. Lieutenant Larry Hawkins, one of the commanders inside the prison, got on the radio and called again for the van. His voice was more panicked. He made the call under duress. A knife was at his throat. The van rolled up to the Sally Port entrance about a minute later. It was shortly after 10 p.m., the night of May 31st, 1984. It was a cool 60 degrees outside and there were clear skies. Mostly everyone inside the Mecklenburg prison had no idea what was unfolding outside Building 1. The six inmates had exited the building at this point, and they couldn't believe how quiet it was. There were no guards in sight, other than the one who drove the van. There were no sirens. There was no commotion. Linwood Briley, the leader of the group of inmates that would later be known in the media as the Mecklenburg Six, knew they were about to go down in history. In part one, we covered the horrific crimes committed by the Briley brothers and detailed how they were finally caught. Their reign of terror was finally over. Except that it wasn't. Today, in part two, the Briley brothers escape from prison, and the city of Richmond was about to be enveloped in fear once again. Today's episode is another one in this storytelling format. It's different than most Court Junkie episodes, but I thought this case with so much detail was fascinating, and I hope you do too. This is Jillian, and in partnership with Law and Crime, you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 172, part 2. Payment apps like Venmo, Cash App, and others make payments easy, but you may want to adjust your privacy settings to prevent them from sharing your personal information. A recent report found that payment apps share user data with third parties, such as banks, fraud monitoring services, and some even share it with marketing firms. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Every day, we put our information at risk on the internet. In an instant, a cyber criminal could harm what's yours, your finances, your credit, your reputation. Good thing there's LifeLock. LifeLock helps detect a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web. You have access to a dedicated restoration specialist if you become a victim. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but you can keep what's yours with LifeLock by Norton. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year at LifeLock.com/court. That's LifeLock.com/court for 25% off. Slow is just right if you're on vacation, you're a sloth, or you're describing QuickBooks. More like slow books. It sucks you in and slows you down with manual processes, integration difficulties, and glitchy delays that leave you scrambling for the numbers you need. Now is the time to make the switch to NetSuite by Oracle, the number one financial system, because NetSuite gives you visibility and control of your financials, inventory, HR, e-commerce, and more. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. With NetSuite, you can automate your processes and close your books in no time, no matter how big your business grows. Failing to switch to NetSuite will leave you stuck trying to make sense of your books while your competitors sprint ahead. 93% of surveyed businesses increased their visibility and control since switching to NetSuite. And right now, special financing is back. NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind financing program only for those ready to switch today. Head to netsuite.com/court right now. Get special financing at netsuite.com/court. That's netsuite.com/court. The escapees raced towards the van. Linwood's younger brother and fellow death row inmate, JB, started yelling at the driver, who at this point had exited the van and was standing around looking confused. JB ordered the guard to get back in the van and park it so that it was facing outward and underneath the open gate. The guard did what he was told. He assumed the man yelling at him was a fellow guard, probably a supervisor. After he parked the van under the gate, the guard opened the rear doors of the van so that those carrying the stretcher could place it in the rear. One of the inmates kept spraying the blanket with the fire extinguisher. JB yelled at the guard once more, telling him to get as far away as he could. The guard literally ran through the open gate, crossed the road towards the woods, slid into a ditch, and covered his head. Linwood hopped in the driver's seat while the others climbed into the back of the van after loading the stretcher. Linwood calmly adjusted the seat, put it in gear, and sped away. The Mecklenburg Six headed down Prison Road towards Highway 58. Linwood got on the radio to tell the guards to close the front gate. They did. The inmates had made it. They'd just escaped from a facility that was designed to be escape-proof. Never before in U.S. history had so many inmates broken out of the same prison at once. The men inside the van were Linwood and J.B. Briley, Earl Clanton, Derek Peterson, Willie Jones, and Lem Tuggle. Six men who were responsible for the slayings of at least 18 people across Virginia were now free, and daybreak was still 8 hours away. Virginia Governor Chuck Robb was about to get the worst wake-up call of his career. The $20 million facility was built in 1977. Virginia Governor Mills Godwin Jr., who was in office when the prison opened, referred to it as a monument to failure. At the time, he was referring to the personal failures of the men housed inside, but those words would come back to haunt him just 7 years later. The Mecklenburg prison was designed to keep predators locked away, safe from law-abiding citizens. When the facility opened, it was touted by Godwin and others as one of the most escape-proof prisons in the world. Visitors from as far away as Japan would visit it to see for themselves the so-called new and improved way to confine dangerous criminals. It was a source of pride for Virginia at the time.
A lot of it's hubris. I mean, you know, and pride. And I think the whole incident and everything that's been written about it is a perfect example of the old biblical, of the old saying, pride goeth before the fall, you know. I mean, over and over and over and over again, the state said nobody can break out of this thing. I mean, you would think that institutions and governments would stop saying that something was perfect because somebody out there is going to go, oh, yeah?
The prison was located in a 189-acre clearing, the lone bare spot in a thick, swampy pine forest. It was surrounded by a double perimeter fence, which was topped with lines of barbed wire. In between the fences were sharp-edged coils. Every inch of the barrier that separated the prison from the outside world was a deterrent from trying to climb it. There were also four towers, each manned by a guard armed with an automatic rifle. The sharpshooters were under orders to shoot to kill if they ever spotted anyone who was attempting to escape. One unique security measure to the Mecklenburg facility was that people entering and exiting had to walk through two doors. The first door would open and the person would walk through it and wait inside a sally port. The first door would close behind that person before the second door opened. In theory, no two doors in the same entryway or exit would ever be open at the same time. That was a critical component of making the prison so difficult to escape from. The prison was expensive to run. It required more manpower than other prisons across the Commonwealth. At other lockups across Virginia, there was one detention officer for every 2.5 inmates. In Mecklenburg, it was closer to one guard for every 1.25 inmates. Following a 4-year suspension, the death penalty was reinstated by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1976, a year or so before Mecklenburg opened. State officials decided to move death row there from its longtime location in the state penitentiary in Richmond, commonly referred to as the Wall. The Mecklenburg Correctional Center may have looked like a friendlier-than-average prison, but it wasn't. The facility drew the attention of the ACLU's National Prison Project, which rated it as one of the most brutal in the country. Privileges were granted to the inmates on death row. They were not locked down all day. They had a day room they could roam around in. They had daily recreation time twice per day. They could talk amongst themselves, except for designated periods when they had to be inside their cells. On this particular day, May 31st, 1984, two of the inmates, Dennis Stockton and Willie Lloyd Turner, asked to go inside early. Dennis had decided late in the process not to take part in the breakout. He opted instead to take his chances with his appeal. It isn't clear why Dennis asked to go back to his pod before the 8 p.m. roundup with the other inmates. It's possible he just wanted some time alone in his cell to reflect, or maybe he wanted to get an early start writing in his diary. Willie Turner had intended to participate in the escape. His job had been to make all of the weapons the inmates needed to overtake the guards. He had hidden the weapons in various places inside his cell and throughout the pod. He wanted to cut his rec time short that night so he could return to the cell block and make preparations. He cooked up an excuse, and the guards allowed him and Dennis to return to the pod. At one point, Willie asked one of the guards, Corporal Harold Crutchfield, for masking tape. He told Crutchfield that he was doing some repairs in his cell. The corporal gave him a roll without asking any questions. Shortly after 8 p.m., the rest of the inmates lined up to return to the cell block. They walked in a single file line towards the building. Everything seemed routine. One of the guards hit the buzzer to the sally port door, and the inmates entered. As they were entering the pod, and while no one was looking, one of the death row inmates, Earl Clanton, jumped out of the line towards the bathroom door. Sometimes the door was locked, and other times it wasn't. The inmates were gambling on it being unlocked on this day. Earl turned the knob and opened the door. He snuck in quickly and quietly, and without a single guard noticing. It was the first of a series of lucky breaks that night for the inmates. The other prisoners kept walking like nothing happened and entered the day room. The guards never did a head count. Before the future escapees were confined to their cells, they discreetly walked over to Willie Turner, who handed each of them one of the homemade knives he had made. After the inmates returned to their cells, a nurse showed up. Every night, Ethel Barksdale, a registered nurse assigned to the prison, would dole out prescription medicine and cups of water to each inmate who needed it. She would fill the paper cups using the sink in the guard's bathroom, the same one Earl Clanton was hiding in. Somehow, the inmates overlooked this detail. Earl had locked the door, so Ethel called out to a guard, who went over to check the doorknob. In that moment, JB told the guard that someone on the day shift mentioned something about the bathroom being out of order. He said he heard that same guard say he would leave a note before the shift change. No note was left on the door, but the on-duty guard shrugged it off. plumbing issues weren't uncommon inside Mecklenburg. Ethel walked to another pod to get the water. She returned and handed out the medications. Afterwards, she and the uniformed guard who was escorting her left the pod to go finish their rounds throughout the rest of the building. While that was going on, one of the inmates called out to another guard to tell him his toilet had a clog. That guard, Corporal Crutchfield, walked to the nearby pipe closet. While that was happening, JB grabbed a paperback book and called out to the control room. He reached out of his cell and signaled to the guard inside, Officer Ricardo Holmes, indicating that he wanted Holmes to hand the book to an inmate on the other side of the control room. Holmes agreed to do so and stepped out. A second after Holmes exited and while his door was still ajar, JB gave his audible signal to Earl. He called out to Earl using his nickname, "Now, Goldie." At that moment, Earl emerged from the bathroom and slipped inside the control room. He knew which button opened the cell doors, and he hit it immediately. Holmes reacted quickly and aggressively. He grabbed Earl and nearly pulled him to the floor. But JB and Linwood, who ran out of their cells as soon as the doors opened, rushed into the booth and grabbed Holmes. The Briley brothers were both holding blades, or shanks as they're commonly called in prison. Linwood told Holmes that he was outnumbered and he was better off surrendering. Meanwhile, Corporal Crutchfield had been inside the pipe closet looking to unclog a leak. After the cell doors opened, Derek Peterson ran to the closet, pressed the blade of his shank against Crutchfield's neck, and whispered to him, "Stay where you are. Don't make a sound." Crutchfield remained still and did what he was told. Three other guards in the pod noticed what was going on, but before they could react, they were surrounded by the other knife-wielding inmates. They were moved to an area by the first tier near the stairs. They were ordered to strip to their underwear. Holmes looked at Earl and told him what he and the others were doing was stupid. They were going to get shot as soon as they left the building. Earl kicked Holmes hard and told him to quit talking. He then forced him to where the other guards were being held. In all, there were four hostages, stripped down to their underwear, holed up inside one of the cells. Corporal Crutchfield had his mouth taped shut with the same masking tape he had given Willie Turner less than an hour earlier, and his hands were cuffed behind his back. He was pushed deeper into the closet and placed between two dripping pipes. The inmates shut the door. In 3 minutes, the inmates had incapacitated five guards inside the pod. The four hostages near the stairs were hog-tied with sheets, shoestrings, and anything else the inmates could find. The inmates threw the guards' uniforms into a pile. One by one, each inmate involved in the escape would dig through the pile looking for a shirt or a pair of pants that would fit them. Linwood and JB settled into their roles. Linwood was the quiet leader, while JB was the one barking all the orders. Both of them knew that they had control of the pod, but they could easily lose control if other guards throughout the prison caught wind of anything. The Brileys knew they needed to incapacitate more of the guards and eventually gain command of the building's control room. The Brileys were ready to start luring more guards into the trap, but the first victim showed up unexpectedly. Officer Donald Gentry was the nurse's escort. He needed to borrow Holmes's elevator key so that the nurse could finish her rounds in the other areas of the prison. He left her behind outside the elevator and walked towards the entrance to death row. Just before he entered, Gentry spotted one of the inmates through a door window. It was Lem Tuggle, and Gentry realized immediately that something was wrong. Here is Lem describing what happened on a homemade recording.
I was in a hallway door, and there's a square window about a foot square in the center of the door, and I was looking out the window, and by the time I looked out, he looked in, and we just looked at each other in the face. And then he recognized me. He knew I wasn't supposed to be out. So the door was not locked, so I just pushed the door open. And of course, I weighed him by about 100 pounds. And I just pushed the door open and rested behind the door and grabbed him, pulled him around. And when I did, he just gave up. I mean, didn't put up a fight or nothing. And I just walked him on down and give him to the other guys down there that was waiting. They either would handcuff them or tie their hands and leave them in the corner down there. Of course, we were taking their clothes from them because we had to get their clothes to wear off, you know, wear out.
Gentry lay in a corner cell with the other guards and wound up just like them, stripped down to his underwear, gagged and hog-tied. Meanwhile, the nurse, Ethel, who was still standing by herself at the elevator, was getting nervous. 1 minute went by, then two, then three. Eventually, she saw a tall man in a guard's uniform approach. As the guard walked closer, Ethel noticed he was carrying something in his hand. It was a blade. Derek Peterson, one of the future escapees, grabbed Ethel and told her not to make any noise. If she did what she was told, she wouldn't get hurt. He escorted her back to the pod. Ethel saw the five guards on the floor inside one of the cells. Linwood and Earl were lurking nearby, smoking marijuana and staring at her. Earl ordered Ethel to strip down, and she did, down to her underwear. Earl and Linwood started fondling her. That's when another inmate showed up. Death row inmate Wilbert Lee Evans walked up behind Linwood and Earl and told them to keep their hands off Ethel. Wilbert's nickname was Slobberjaws. He may have been the inmate with the scariest appearance on death row, but by all accounts, he was the one who showed the most humanity during the escape. Earl told Wilbert that Ethel needed to be stripped down so that she wouldn't run away. Wilbert waved him off and told him she wasn't going anywhere and that he needed to put a blanket over her. Earl told Wilbert to go get his own blanket. Earl and Linwood tied Ethel up and started groping her again. Wilbert returned seconds later, holding a blanket, and told Earl and Linwood in a louder voice to leave her alone. Earl and Linwood walked away, and Wilbert covered Ethel with the blanket. He assured her she would not be harmed and told her he would use a nightstick on anyone who touched her again. In that moment, Ethel thanked Wilbert. She would later tell authorities that Wilbert probably saved her life. A second nurse would enter the pod, Maud Boyd. She was worried about Ethel and wanted to know why her coworker hadn't finished her rounds. The inmates swooped around Maud and led her to Lem's cell. She, too, got scared after seeing the half-naked guards on the floor of one of the other cells. She got even more scared when she was escorted into the cell of a known rapist and killer. Lem was actually pleasant towards her. He turned on his radio and told her, "Make yourself comfortable. My home is your home." As the night unfolded, the inmates would get on the radio and lure more guards to C-Pod. One by one, the guards were apprehended by Earl Clanton, Linwood Riley, and Lem Tuggle. Earl and Lem had the size advantage over all of them. Most of the guards didn't resist, especially after they saw that all of the inmates were armed with knives. The inmates wanted senior officers among the hostages, for the simple reason that they wanted their uniforms. The white shirts the senior officers wore gave them an aura of authority. The thinking was that if the guards outside the pod saw one or more white shirts walking through the prison, they wouldn't get suspicious. A call was made to Lieutenant Larry Hawkins. One of the hostages was ordered by the armed inmates to tell him over the phone that he needed to come to C-Pod to help a wounded inmate. Lieutenant Hawkins sent someone else instead, a lieutenant by the name of Milton Crutchfield. At 9:10 p.m., Lieutenant Crutchfield entered the pod and was immediately surrounded by armed inmates. Another officer, John Mayo, showed up at the pod soon thereafter to assist Lieutenant Crutchfield. He, too, was apprehended. By then, the prison's design was working in the inmates' favor. The doors would automatically lock after they were shut. Once a guard entered the pod and saw what was happening, There was no chance for him to make a quick getaway. Every entrance and exit required a key or someone to press a button. At 9:13 p.m., Lieutenant Hawkins noticed Lieutenant Crutchfield hadn't called back. He had sent Officer Mayo to help him, and he hadn't heard from him either. Lieutenant Hawkins called the pod's extension, and there was no answer, so he decided to investigate. He walked up the stairs and didn't notice Earl and Lem hiding near the stairwell. Their assignment was to grab and subdue anyone who entered. Lieutenant Hawkins got close to the top of the stairs and looked into the pod. He noticed that all the cell doors were open. He made eye contact with Derek Peterson at the top of the stairs, and both men froze for a moment. Lieutenant Hawkins turned to run back down the stairs, and Derek yelled out for someone to catch him. Earl and Lem were already in position. The inmates now had more than a dozen hostages tied up. Those hostages included two nurses and two lieutenants. JB was the one in control. He had weapons, a radio, and was wearing a uniform. He had on one of the white shirts with gold bars on it. JB was reportedly tempted to send a message by killing one or more of the guards, but he ultimately decided against it because it would take too much time. He and the other inmates knew they had to act fast if they had any hope of a successful escape. JB grabbed Lieutenant Hawkins once more and told him what he wanted the senior officer to say over the guards' radios. Lieutenant Hawkins said the following in a loud voice. "Stay off the phones. There's an emergency here." Lieutenant Hawkins called for a van to be parked at the front Sallyport gate. The inmates had to gain control of the ground-level control room in order to get outside. Two of the inmates volunteered to remain in the C-pod, Willie Turner and Joe Geritano. It was Joe's job to remain in the booth and work the controls in case the inmates had to come back. Turner volunteered to stay behind to keep an eye on the hostages. Neither inmate seemed committed to the idea of escaping. Either they feared death or they didn't have any faith that the plan would keep working outside the walls of the cell block. They had reason to be skeptical. Not everything was going smoothly. The prisoners wanted to put all the hostages into the bottom-tier laundry room, but nobody had a key. One of the guards spoke up and said that whoever was wearing his pants had the key. JB checked his pockets and found it. It was clear that the escapees were figuring things out as they went along. It seemed it was only a matter of time before they'd run out of luck. Officer Corleen Thomas was the one manning Building 1's control booth. She started to worry about what was happening in C-Pod. Ever since hearing Lieutenant Hawkins' voice on the radio about bringing a van to the Sallyport, she also noticed that she had been buzzing in guards and none had returned. She got a call from an officer that someone from the outside was trying to reach her by phone. Corleen was a single mother of an infant and worried it might be an emergency. She was told that another guard in a different area of the building would come by to relieve her. That was a violation of protocol, but she never second-guessed it. She saw a uniformed man coming towards her. She didn't recognize him, but he was tall and was sporting a smile. She figured he was a new transfer. Corleen unlocked the door to the control room. The officer entered and immediately knocked her to the ground. As soon as she fell to the floor, the man in uniform grabbed her wrists and handcuffed her. The man inside the control room was inmate Derek Peterson. He ordered Corleen to remain on the floor and away from the window. He picked up the phone, called the C-Pod extension, and told JB that he had control of the booth. He heard JB tell the others, "He's in." He could hear the cheering through the receiver. It was 10:35 p.m., and every major door inside Building 1, which included the entrance to death row, was now controlled by the prisoners. In the end, five inmates decided to walk out of the pod together towards the van. Linwood and JB, Earl Clanton, Lem Tuggle, and Willie Jones. Willie Turner and Joe Geritano would catch up with them before they drove away. That was the original plan. The other escapee, Derek Peterson, was already waiting for the others in the main control room at the ground level. Derek got a call from another guard in another building. He answered, and immediately the guard on the other line was suspicious. He was expecting to hear a female voice. "Who is this?" the guard on the other end of the line asked. "Where's Officer Thomas?" Derek said she was gone and didn't know where she was. The guard kept talking and Derek hung up. The phone rang again and Derek didn't know what to do. After a few rings, he finally picked up the phone, but he had no idea what to say. On the other end of the line was Joe Geritano. He asked Derek why he had been tying up the line. Before Derek could answer, Joe told him that the others were standing by on the other side of the door, waiting to be buzzed through. JB entered the control room first. He saw Corlene Thomas on the floor and pulled her to her feet. He demanded she tell him what button to push for the main exit. She hesitated and then felt JB's blade pressed up against her neck. She pointed to the button. Corlene was forced inside a bathroom and the inmates locked her inside. They opened the closet where the riot gear was stored and put on helmets and grabbed shields. They found a fire extinguisher and a green canvas stretcher. Each prisoner also grabbed a gas mask. They decided they needed to place something on the stretcher. They needed something that could be covered with a blanket and pass for a bomb. They decided on the television set that was upstairs in the sea pod. Before they went back upstairs, Derek opened the exit door. The inmates expected to see a van, but it hadn't showed up yet. JB called the death row pod again and told Joe to grab the watch commander, Lieutenant Hawkins. Joe buzzed the inmates in. At this point, JB and the others assumed Joe and Willie Turner would join them on their way back down. Instead, they told JB they weren't going.
"We just took off for the gate. Well, now the two that other two that were supposed to go, they changed their minds and made escape. I guess they really didn't think it was going to work because, you know, that's why they went along with it. They didn't think it was going to really get out. And when it come to that point, they just refused to go because they were afraid that we were going to get shot down going out the gate. Well, the way I was looking at it, hey, I'm going to get killed if I stay here, so what difference does it make if I get shot down going out the gate? So, anyway, they stayed. We didn't give them no beef about it, you know, and they stayed. And we went on."
Joe Geritano would later become a famous advocate in the Virginia legal community. In 1991, his death sentence was commuted to life in prison with parole eligibility after 25 years. With time already served in 1991, he became eligible for parole in 2004. The parole board granted his release in 2017. He's a free man today, the only Virginia death row inmate from Mecklenburg who can say that. JB kept calm about Joe and Willie Turner pulling out, but he was still stewing over the missing van. He grabbed Lieutenant Hawkins and told him he was taking a trip with him downstairs. While in the pod, the other escapees grabbed the television set.
"We took and loaded up a TV. We had the pod TV, which is a 19-inch, what was it, RCA, I think. And we took a stretcher, and we put the TV on the stretcher and covered it with a blanket. A TV, now, can you imagine a bomb being as big as a TV and people on death row making a bomb that big? I mean, it was hilarious."
Joe unlocked the door from the control booth, and the six inmates ran back down the stairs, this time with Lieutenant Hawkins in tow. After everyone was downstairs, Lieutenant Hawkins radioed for the van again and was told by another guard that it was on its way from another area of the prison. A minute or so later, the van rolled up. Lieutenant Hawkins was led back up the stairs to join the other hostages. At 10:38 p.m., the inmates started running towards the van, carrying the stretcher with the TV on it. Lem, Earl, Willie Jones, and JB each held a corner of the stretcher while Linwood sprayed the covered-up television with the fire extinguisher. Seconds later, everyone was in the van. Linwood was the driver. The keys were in the ignition and the engine was running. Off they went. It had taken a little more than 2 hours for the inmates to prove to the country that its most secure prison was not what its designers thought it to be. When's the last time you got rewarded for brushing your teeth? I know when I was trying to get my daughter to regularly brush hers, I'd always try to add an incentive in there. But unfortunately, we don't normally get rewarded for brushing our teeth as adults. But with Quip's smart electric toothbrush, good habits can earn you great perks, like free products, gift cards, and more. Here's how it works. The Quip Smart Brush connects to the Quip app with Bluetooth, and then you can track when and how well you brush and get tips and coaching to improve your habits. Then earn points for daily brushing and bonus points for completing challenges. You then redeem those points for rewards from Quip and their partners. In addition to brush heads, Quip also delivers fresh floss, toothpaste, mouthwash, and sugar-free gum refills every 3 months from $5. Shipping is free, so you can save money and skip the hustle and bustle of in-store shopping. Start getting rewards for brushing your teeth today. Go to getquip.com/court right now to save $10 on a Quip Smart Electric Toothbrush. That's $10 off a smart electric toothbrush at getquip.com/court, spelled GETQUIP.com/court. Quip, the good habits company. You can protect your home with Ring Alarm. For a special offer, visit ring.com/court. Well, a few months ago, we installed the Ring video doorbell, and I love it. With Ring, I'm able to see who's at my door without even opening it, whether I'm home or away. It's the perfect way to start your Ring experience. Ring Alarm allows you to keep an eye on every corner of your house with their easy-to-install indoor and outdoor cams. Then you can use your Ring app to see what's happening from anywhere. Ring Alarm offers you peace of mind, knowing that your house is protected. Protect your home anytime from anywhere with Ring Alarm. Go to ring.com/court for a special offer on a Ring Alarm security kit today. You can build a system that's right for your home and have it up and running in minutes. That's ring.com/court. ring.com/court. After the Mecklenburg Six headed down the highway, Joe Giratano and Willie Turner kept the hostages where they were for 30 minutes. They had promised the escapees that they would do so to give them a head start. The hostages were finally freed from the laundry room, but it took some extra time because the key to the room had been lost during the chaos. One of the inmates had to yank out the steel mesh that covered the door. One by one, the hostages crawled out, shaken at what they had been through. Corporal Crutchfield, the lone hostage who was held in the pipe closet, remained where he was for another hour. The key to that room had been lost, too. The entire pod had been ransacked. The on-duty guards who had been stuck inside were still in a daze over what had happened and weren't sure what to do. Here's Joe Jackson, a former reporter of the Virginian Pilot in Norfolk, who co-wrote a book about the escape. Some of the source material used for the book came from Dennis Stockton's personal diary.
But after the six escapees drove off and the supposed bomb was out of the prison, there was just this kind of like period of shock. And then, you know, the prison guards dressed in their SWAT finery, came back in force and found what the scene actually was. And none of the prisoners who had been involved in the escape, I mean, none of them really fought back. I mean, some of them already were in their cells. But it took a little while. I mean, there was, if anything, it was like shock.
During the next few weeks, the death row inmates in Mecklenburg were basically placed in solitary confinement while the fugitives remained on the loose. 3 days out of the week, they were allowed a 5-minute shower. Otherwise, they remained confined to their small cells. The state requested the courts to throw out any appeals of the escapees, but that filing was rejected. It was deemed unconstitutional. While the abducted guards were recovering and word was getting out about the escape, the Mecklenburg Six were heading south on Route 4. They entered North Carolina and pulled into Warrenton, a town of about 900 people. The inmates were 30 miles southeast of the prison and figured the call had already been made about the escape. They knew they had to ditch the van someplace. Beyond that, they had no plan. Everyone in the van was arguing when Linwood took a turn down a dead-end street. He pulled onto the property of an empty school and parked the van by a playground near a tree line. Linwood was reportedly tired of hearing everyone else yelling about what he needed to do next. He probably could have found a better place to hide the van, but he had run out of patience. He also thought he was better off abandoning the vehicle as soon as possible. The sooner he could find another car to leave town in, the better. JB followed Linwood, and so did Willie and Lem. Derek and Earl split from the group. It was shortly after midnight when Andrew Davis, an orderly at a nearby hospital, was driving home from work. He stopped at a stoplight and heard two men call out to him. Everyone knows everyone in Warrenton, so Davis assumed the guys were people he knew. As the men approached, he got a look at their faces. He didn't recognize them, but because they were wearing clothes that looked like police uniforms, he wasn't worried. The two men were Derek Peterson and Earl Clanton. The men asked him for a ride. Davis hadn't had a chance to answer before one of them hopped into the passenger seat. The other man got in the back. That's when Davis started to worry. One of the men asked where people go in town to buy drugs. Davis told him he didn't know. Then they asked him where people hung out late at night. He told them, "Mister, this town folds up its sidewalks at 10 o'clock. The man in the back seat grunted and glared at Davis, who was becoming more uneasy. He asked them where they wanted to go, and the one in the passenger seat said, "We'll just get out wherever you stop." Davis wasn't about to take them home where his wife and four kids were sleeping, so he drove about a half mile out of town and stopped. He told the men he wasn't going any farther with them. The man in the front seat went for the keys, and the man in the back reached forward with a knife in his hand. Davis assumed he was going to be cut, stabbed, and possibly killed. He yelled as loud as he could and threw up his arms, which jarred the knife loose from the man in the back seat. He kicked at the man in the passenger seat in an effort to force him out of the car. During the struggle, Davis was the one who wound up outside the car and on the ground. He got on his feet and ran away. He made a dash for the closest house. He kept yelling, waking up the people inside. He then used their phone to call the police. Derek and Earl got spooked and ran into some thick woods. Around that time, a patrol officer discovered the stolen van. The hunt was on. Around 2 o'clock in the morning, Governor Chuck Robb got the call that six death row inmates had escaped from Mecklenburg. He called the National Guard. Around the same time, the director of the Department of Corrections, Robert Landon, got a knock on his hotel room door in Williamsburg. He was there on a business trip. He couldn't believe what he was hearing. There had been an escape at the facility built specifically to prevent escapes. Glenn Barber is the chairman of the Mecklenburg County Board of Supervisors and a Mecklenburg native. He remembers getting a call 37 years ago about the escape. He also had a gobsmacked reaction to the news.
I think I got a phone call from a friend of mine, as I recall, and he said, have you heard the news? And I'm like, what's that? And he said, well, they've had a prison break in Mecklenburg. And I'm like, you got to be kidding. That's not possible. I mean, it's a maximum security facility and of course, after he let me know about it, then I went to the local news that evening or something, and it was, of course, all over all over the news and the radio. And it was quite a stir in our community.
Before long, local and state police started combing the area around Warrenton. Earl and Derek, who were still hiding in the woods, could actually hear the howling dogs and their handlers closing in on them. If the escapees hadn't already had enough breaks go their way for one night, Earl and Derek got another. The closest search party to them inexplicably turned and started moving in a different direction. Had they kept going for another 50 yards or so, they would have nabbed them. Instead, Earl and Derek went unnoticed and were still free. The sun was about to rise, and a larger mass of law enforcement officers was forming in Warren County to start looking for the six inmates. The searchers were from the Warrenton and Henderson Police Departments, the Virginia State Police, the North Carolina Highway Patrol, the North Carolina State Bureau of Criminal Investigations, the National Guard, and the FBI. The agencies brought bloodhounds, helicopters with infrared equipment, pontoon boats, SWAT vehicles, and anything else they could bring with them that they felt could help them track and apprehend the Mecklenburg Six. The paranoia made for a dangerous environment. Armed police and armed citizens alike were on edge about ruthless killers being on the loose. A Virginia Department of Corrections spokesman literally said that if he were a black man in Warrenton, he wouldn't be walking in the woods for fear of being shot on sight. There were black men in Warren County who wore signs over their shirts with the words, "I'm not one of the Briley brothers." A Philadelphia Inquirer reporter traveled to Warrenton to cover the escape. He interviewed one woman who ran a small used car dealership in town. She told the reporter, "We're all sitting around holding guns in our hands." After the news broke about the escape and the subsequent attempted carjacking in downtown, residents in Warrenton were frozen in fear. But the fear wasn't contained to that small town.
It was a pretty scary time. Of course, nobody knew where these guys were. They, you know, could have been running through your backyard for all you knew. So folks were pretty scared about the whole situation.
Residents in Mecklenburg County, Virginia, and Warren County, North Carolina, were very afraid, as were people in Richmond. The city's most feared serial killers were on the loose again, and nobody knew where they were. Everyone who played a part in the arrests and convictions of the Briley brothers were offered a security detail of some sort. A lot of them took it. Dale Brumfield, a Richmond-area writer who has researched the 1984 prison escape, remembers the city essentially being on lockdown after the news broke.
Everybody was worried that the Brileys were going to come back to Richmond and start their rampage of terror all over again. That was the big thing. I remember signs going up. You know, this was before email and cell phones and things like this. So these signs, these flyers were being posted that says, "Don't walk alone. Walk in pairs, walk in threes," especially around the VCU area. The newspaper was saying, you know, "Keep your doors locked, keep your car locked, close your windows." I mean, it was like, you know, the devil himself was coming back to Richmond.
While two of the escaped inmates were trapped in the woods of Warren County, the remaining four escapees had decided to walk south towards Afton along U.S. Route 401. They eventually came upon a house with a pickup truck parked in the front yard. It was unlocked, and keys were inside. It was still hours until dawn. Linwood, J.B., and Willie Jones got in the truck, while Lem Tuggle rode in the back. They decided to head north. Strangely, they decided not to take a different route. They drove past the entrance road to the prison.
We drove right back by Mecklenburg, the institution. I mean, right back by the road. We was just a few hundred yards from the prison. And that's something they would have never expected. And we saw all these cars and all these cop cars and everything all going up into the prison and everything. We just drove right on through them, kept right on going.
After the sun came up on the morning of June 1st, Earl Clanton and Derek Peterson were still in the woods. The mosquitoes were taking a toll on them, especially Earl. They took off their guard uniforms and walked into town. Derek had on a sweatsuit, and Earl had on a pair of sweatpants and a white t-shirt. They had found the sweats hanging off a clothesline during the night while they were searching for a place to hide. Earl kept his guard's jacket on. He tore off the Mecklenburg patches, thinking that would be enough to ward off suspicion. The two men came upon a convenience store called Willoughby's. They bought wine, hoop cheese, cigarettes, and bread, and grabbed seats at the laundromat that was next door. They sat down and started eating and drinking. The people inside the store were friendly to them. Everyone was talking about the prison escape, not realizing the two men who had just walked inside made up one-third of the Mecklenburg Six. They made their first mistake when they used the payphone outside the store. The FBI was monitoring calls to certain telephone numbers throughout Virginia, presumably relatives and potential accomplices of the escaped inmates. A call made to Derek's mother was traced to the Willoughby's payphone. Police came to the store but didn't look inside the laundromat next door. Later in the day, two members of the North Carolina Prison Emergency Response Team, known as PERT, slowly drove by Willoughby's. One of the PERT members looked through the large window into the laundromat. He noticed one of the men wearing what looked like a prison guard jacket. Shortly before 6 p.m., less than 20 hours after they had escaped, those two PERT members entered the laundromat and arrested them. Following the rather quick apprehension of Earl and Derek, authorities assumed the other four inmates were close. Search parties remained in and around Warren County for several days. They canvassed woods, swamps, ponds, open fields with tall grass, places that were rife with mosquitoes, ticks, and venomous snakes. It was a difficult job for those taking part in the searches. Bug spray was brought in by the truckload. Calls about possible sightings of the escaped inmates were coming in from across North Carolina and Virginia. All of them had to be followed up on. 1 week after the first two escapees were arrested, authorities discovered they were searching in all the wrong places. During the early morning hours of June 1st, Linwood, J.B., Lem, and Willie headed north and passed through Richmond, the city that the Brileys had terrorized 5 years earlier. They knew they couldn't stop there. Law enforcement would be patrolling every street, and police officers there definitely knew what the Brileys looked like.
And once we got out of Virginia, we stopped and went to this little place, like a little Minute Mart, and got a six-pack of beer and some food, some cigarettes. And that was the first beer I'd had in a long time. But it tasted good. It tasted real good. And by this, I mean, it was just real. It was just sinking in that we had actually got out. I mean, we was on a high like you wouldn't believe, and it was all Nashville. I mean, we was excited and screaming and hollering and just having a good time.
The group of four drove another 200 miles north from that mini mart. They didn't stop until they got to Philadelphia. During the drive, the inmates listened to the news of the escape on the radio. They laughed, drank beer, and smoked marijuana until they got to a section of the city known as North Philly. The Briley brothers bought some clothes at a thrift shop and told Lem and Willie to keep driving. They had an uncle who lived nearby, and they would be staying behind. The group went to a public park close to where the Briley's uncle lived, and that's where they ditched their stolen guard uniforms. Willie Jones wanted to stay with the Briley's. He begged Linwood to allow him to join, but Linwood refused. The group had almost $800 in cash. The money was removed from the pockets of all the guards and nurses they had taken hostage the night before. Lem was given $25, and the Briley's kept the rest. Lem was now in the driver's seat of the stolen truck. Willie sulked and climbed into the passenger seat. Lem asked Willie where he wanted to go. Willie told him he didn't care. Lem suggested they head for Canada. Whether they knew it or not, Canada was probably the best option for them. The Canadian border wasn't all that secure back in 1984, and their government was not inclined to transport fugitives back to the United States if they were facing the death penalty. Lem and Willie were north of Boston when they heard on the radio news that two of their fellow escapees had been caught. They were 800 miles from Warrenton and more than three quarters of the way to Canada by then. When he ran low on money and gas, Lem hawked some of the items from inside the truck. He sold the spare tire and jack. He also sold a nightstick that the inmates had stolen from one of the Mecklenburg prison guards. From those sales, Lem was able to scrape together enough cash to fill the gas tank. When the tank got low again, they came upon an empty cabin in rural Massachusetts. That's where they caught another break.
And there was two refrigerators. And after I made sure there was nobody in there, I opened one refrigerator and there was nothing in it. I mean, it'd been unplugged. I said, oh, well, maybe we're not going to get nothing. Went to the other refrigerator and opened it up, and it was full of food. And had two great old big six packs of ice cold Canadian beer in the bottles. And first thing I did was pop the top on one of the bottles and drank that down real quick. And whoever lived there was rich. I mean, they had these giant cigars that was in the tubes, the more real expensive ones. They was laying around all over the place. So now we had beer and cigars and food. And we looked under a cabinet. We found six gallons of different kinds of liquor. And then we, upstairs, we found sleeping bags, all kind of camping equipment. The place had a color TV, stereo. Found a hunting knife. Found all kind of stuff.
Lem sold the television he stole from the cabin to a stranger near the Vermont state line. He pocketed the $75 and bought some more gas, food, cigarettes, and clothes. They entered into Vermont and found a tent at an abandoned campsite in the area of Woodford. The tent had some holes in it, but they used plastic trash bags to cover them up. A heavy rain came and the tent protected them from the rain, but the truck was parked on some soft dirt, and so after the rains came, the dirt turned to mud and the truck got stuck. Lem walked to a nearby motel that was next to a gift shop and found someone who agreed to help him pull the truck out of the mud. The man who helped Lem got a look at the license plate. It was a North Carolina tag, and it read PE1. The media had been reporting that police suspected the inmates had stolen a truck with that very license plate. Lem found out later that the man who helped him get the truck out of the mud reported what he saw to local law enforcement. But no one at the police precinct took him seriously. They didn't think a prison escapee could make it that far so fast. But Lem and Willie's luck was finally about to change. They eventually made it to Jay Peak Resort, about 7 miles from the Canadian border. They weren't aware how close they were to Canada. Had they known, they probably would have kept driving a little more, using a back road and then walking the rest of the way. That was the plan all along. Take a rural road, park close to the border, and walk into Canada. Instead, Lem and Willie decided to spend the night under a tent on the resort property, which was abandoned that time of year. It rained all night, which meant more standing water outside the tent. By then, Lem and Willie had mosquito bites all over their arms, necks, and faces. The following morning, Lem headed out to the nearest store to pick up food before they would make their escape into Canada. He ended up getting lost and nearly ran out of gas. He decided to rob the gift shop he had visited days earlier when the truck got stuck. He grabbed the hunting knife he had stolen from the cabin and used it to scare the woman behind the register. He grabbed the money and took off. The woman was shaken, but she got a good look at the truck the robber was driving. She noticed it had North Carolina tags. When she called the police, she mentioned that specifically. Lem didn't drive far before a local constable, who had heard the robbery call over his radio, spotted the truck and started tailing it. The constable was the only law enforcement officer in Stamford, a quiet town of about 800 residents. He normally investigated bicycle thefts and trespassing calls. But on this day, he was chasing one of the most highly sought-after fugitives in America, a twice-convicted murderer. Another law enforcement officer set up a roadblock down the road, and Lem was trapped. He surrendered without resisting arrest. As the constable closed in on him with his gun drawn, Lem told him, "I'm Lem, and I'm wanted in Virginia." Willie Jones, meanwhile, was all alone in the middle of an empty ski resort. After a few hours, he figured Lem wasn't coming back. He broke into a house and used a telephone. He called his mother, who urged him to turn himself in. The next call Willie made was to the local sheriff's office. He gave the emergency operator his location, and he was picked up around 5:30 p.m., about 4 hours after Lem had been captured. 9 days after the escape, 4 of the 6 death row inmates had been caught. There were just 2 remaining, the most dangerous ones. Federal, state, and local authorities all said so publicly. They were convinced that the Brileys would put up a fight if they were found. Residents across Virginia and beyond were still wary of Briley sightings.
Everybody was holding their breath and praying that they'd be caught, you know, any day. There was a lot of speculation about where these guys, a lot of folks, I think, thought maybe they had gone back and were holed up in Richmond somewhere with some, you know, relatives or friends hiding them out or whatever. You know, a lot of people commented that, you know, they were sleeping with a firearm on their nightstand. I mean, and, you know, you didn't knock on the door, anybody's door after a certain hour at night, that's for sure.
The national media kept printing and airing stories about how dangerous the brothers were. Warren Von Schuch, one of the assistant Commonwealth attorneys who prosecuted the brothers, told UPI in a June 11th interview, quote, "The Brileys are in a class by themselves. They are incredibly, inhumanely mean. They are killing machines." That wire story was printed in newspapers across the United States. Meanwhile, the Brileys were still hiding out in North Philly. They were working at an auto garage run by their uncle's friend, Dan Latham. The uncle's house was under surveillance for more than a week, but there had been no sign of the Briley brothers being there. The Briley's uncle, Johnny Lee Council, seemed to be an inconsequential person in the neighborhood. He kept to himself and didn't talk much. Unbeknownst to him and to his neighbors, the FBI was watching him closer than just about any other U.S. citizen during that time. The close watch began not long after Lem's capture. Lem had told the FBI where he last saw the Brileys, at a park in North Philly. The Brileys had hidden a badge inside a hole in a thick oak tree. The badge was from one of the guards' uniforms they had stolen. Lem gave a detailed description of where the badge could be found. The FBI's lead investigator was skeptical that Lem was telling the truth, but he decided to send some agents to the scene to take a look. They found the badge. The FBI learned that the Brileys' uncle lived a few blocks from the park where the badge was found. They wasted no time requesting and obtaining wiretaps for Johnny Lee Council's home. Agents also staked it out. Before long, the FBI noticed phone calls being made from the uncle's home to Latham's shop, so they started surveilling the business, located on 2nd Street. The Brileys had been hired by Latham to fix up the garage and to help out with various odd jobs. The two men slept on cots and did what they were told. Latham had no idea who his new employees were. The FBI sent an informant to the garage, and he positively identified JB. Agents watching through binoculars and high-powered camera lenses also identified the brothers. the authorities decided it was time to move in. By this point, the brothers were getting to know people in the neighborhood. Linwood went by Lucky, and JB went by Slim. No one had a worry in the world about Lucky and Slim. They seemed like mild-mannered guys. They spoke with Richmond accents, but that was the only part about them that seemed out of place. On June 19th, Latham, Johnny Lee Council, the Briley brothers, and several more people in the neighborhood were hanging around in the alley next to the shop, grilling chicken. The FBI waited for the right time to strike. They decided to do so around 10 p.m. Six cars and a large white van converged on the business, and 20 or so agents got out and yelled, "Freeze, FBI!" The stunned Brileys went to the ground on command. Surprisingly, they surrendered peacefully, something authorities, fellow inmates, observers, even family members didn't expect. They were unarmed, outmanned, and taken by surprise. Johnny Lee Council, the Briley's uncle, was charged with harboring fugitives. He told the FBI that he figured he was going to be approached by investigators because his name was on the visitors' log at the prison. He told them that he had no choice but to help his nephews. He was too scared of them to refuse. The Briley brothers were taken into custody and each was held on $10 million bail. Johnny Lee Council's bail was set at $1 million. He was later acquitted in federal court of his charges. After the brothers were arrested, they were escorted to a local jail. Linwood kept his head down and never looked at the cameras. JB was more talkative. He had on a shower cap and covered his face with his hands. He never made eye contact with the media, but he did speak to them.
"I want to talk to the governor of Virginia.
Mr. Briley, you say you're innocent?"
"I am innocent of everything that was done in Virginia."
19 days from the very hour the six inmates had escaped, the manhunt had ended. Aside from a couple of shaken business owners, one in rural Vermont and another in North Philly, there were no casualties following the escape. It was all over.
It was certainly a sigh of relief. People felt like then, they could kind of get their lives back to some sense of normalcy, because it was a life-changing experience for the people of Mecklenburg, because these guys were nobody to fool around with. They'd proven that. They were pretty cold-blooded and hardcore, and they were not the kind of people you wanted to come face to face with.
Conditions at the Mecklenburg Correctional Center would not improve for a while. On July 12th, about 3.5 weeks after the Brileys were captured, there was a major riot at the prison. A SWAT team arrived and quelled the riot, but just as that one ended, inmates in a separate building started another one. By the time it was over, 15 people were hospitalized, including 9 guards. During the next several weeks, there would be more riots. Guards would retaliate with shakedowns and attacks, oftentimes leaving inmates with broken bones from savage baton beatings. In August, another riot took place. This time, guards were once again taken hostage. The rioters demanded an end to their brutal treatment, and the incident ended after prison officials agreed to look into their complaints. 2 guards were hospitalized in that incident after being stabbed in the head with homemade knives. Prisoners at other facilities across Virginia started copying what their peers were doing in Mecklenburg. Riots took place inside prisons from Richmond to Staunton. The warden at Mecklenburg, Gary Bass, was suspended and reassigned in the wake of the death row escape. The same went for his head of security. 5 of the guards who were taken hostage during the escape were fired. The chief of the Department of Corrections eventually resigned, as did the state secretary of public safety. Heads were going to roll when it became clear that administrative incompetence and outright corruption played a part in the escape. it wasn't simply a matter of ingenuity on the part of the prisoners. That had become clear to everyone. Here again is author Dale Brumfield.
He said, yeah, they weren't Bond villains, but they were smart enough to notice as early as 1983 that the guard protocols and the procedures weren't very... the prison was, they said it was escape-proof. Mecklenburg County Correctional Center was touted as being the most secure facility in America, and it was escape-proof. Well, that was just a challenge to people like the Brileys. And they quickly noticed by watching the guards and being friendly with the guards, and the guards, the one guard at least started bringing James Briley pot into the, and Briley had 75 marijuana cigarettes in his cell during one shakedown. Another guard, Dennis Stockton, another death row inmate, claimed that a guard was bringing in knives to James Briley. One of the guards, right before the an hour before the breakout occurred, handed Willie Turner a roll of tape when Turner came in to get all the knives out of the hiding place. They couldn't find the knives. They had warning after warning after warning.
Many changes were implemented in Mecklenburg and elsewhere. Attorney-inmate interviews were less restrictive, and the entire screening process for new prison employees was revamped. Those steps led to incremental improvements, but Mecklenburg remained a nuisance for the state. Its notorious reputation never got peeled away. In November 1985, Lem Tuggle was involved in another attempted escape, but it was stopped when the guard inside the control booth kept his cool and called the prisoner's bluff. Lem was reportedly involved in a third escape attempt 2 years later, but authorities caught wind of that one before he or any of the other inmates made their first move. Not long afterward, it seems Mecklenburg's days were numbered. The entire Department of Corrections also operated differently as a result of the problems there. In 1993, 2 years after death row was moved to another prison facility, Governor Doug Wilder proposed that Mecklenburg be closed. Later that year, George Allen was elected governor. He brought with him a tough-on-crime attitude. Parole was abolished under Allen's watch, and executions were ramped up even more. Allen decided to keep Mecklenburg open, but it was downgraded to a medium-security intake prison. The decision was finally made in 2011 by Governor Bob McDonnell to close Mecklenburg and demolish it. The final demolitions were completed in late 2017.
It was outdated, believe it or not. I mean, it went from state-of-the-art to antique. And so the state tore it down, and the property that it was built on reverted back to Mecklenburg County, because we actually owned it at the time. And now, thankfully, we have a Microsoft facility, cloud facility being built there.
The site where the Mecklenburg Correctional Facility once stood is now being built into something vastly different, the largest Microsoft data center in the world. To date, the company has reportedly invested more than $2 billion at the site.
I don't know that when the prison was built, I can't say that the county maybe was necessarily proud of having a prison. What they were proud of was creating several hundred jobs. And they actually had to build a road into that site. There wasn't even a road there. It was called Prison Road. So now that Microsoft is developing down there, we're having the name of the road changed. We don't think Prison Road is appropriate.
And so the state of Virginia's perception of Mecklenburg as a workable facility to house dangerous criminals had changed. But its perception of the death penalty did not, at least not for several more years. All six of the escapees wound up being executed. The most significant of those executions was the first one, the execution of Linwood Briley. Linwood never returned to Mecklenburg. Instead, he was housed at the Wall in Richmond. Following his capture, weeks went by, and Linwood started coming to grips with the inevitability that he was going to be executed. He apparently took solace in knowing that he got to taste freedom one last time. He told a journalist, "I had my 19 days of freedom. They can't take that away." The chair literally had to be dusted before it could be used. It had only been used once since the death penalty was restored in 1976. And that was in 1982, when the state executed ex-police officer Frank Coppola, who had been convicted for the 1978 beating death of a Newport News woman. Linwood's execution date was set for October 12, 1984. And although he had appeared to fear little throughout his life, he felt differently now. He told the Richmond Times-Dispatch during an interview, quote, "I'm afraid of it. I don't want to be executed." Those words appeared in a story published on September 30th, 12 days before Linwood was scheduled to die. In that same interview, Linwood again claimed his innocence. During his life, he had only admitted to killing one of the murder victims linked to him. He admitted to killing Orlene Christian, who he shot from his bedroom window as a teenager. He maintained during his last interview that that shooting was accidental. He had been aiming for a bird, he said. Jack W. Gravely, who at the time was the Virginia director of the NAACP, openly admitted to the Washington Post prior to Linwood's execution that his organization, normally a vigorous opponent of the death penalty, wasn't taking such a hard stance against it this time around. He told the Post, quote, "People in Richmond feel that crimes committed by this individual to be so heinous and so vicious and so violent, I just think it has quelled the voices that would speak out. The crimes reeked of a kind of mentality that we feel the community, especially the Black community, could not condone." On the day of Linwood's execution, the U.S. Supreme Court voted 7-2 to reject an emergency petition, asking for time to prepare another appeal, challenging Linwood's conviction and death sentence for the killing of Johnny G. His attorneys went to the lower court seeking stays, but each effort came up empty. Governor Chuck Robb also declined to intervene. The execution was big news, especially in Richmond. A pro-death penalty crowd formed outside the prison, while a group of anti-death penalty activists stood on the other side. Dale Brumfield, now an anti-death penalty activist, covered the execution for Throttle magazine, a local monthly counterculture magazine that he had helped found in the early 1980s.
What surprised me was the number of people that showed up to support Briley's execution, because there were none of those people at the Coppola execution 2 years earlier. And these people had come down out of Oregon Hill and come from, I don't know what cracks in the woodwork they came out of, but there was about 100 of them. And the best phrase that the most complimentary thing I can describe them as were drunken yahoos. And they held up homemade signs that said, "Fry Briley, fry, kill the, you know what." They were racist. I mean, there were just racist invectives being thrown around. It was like, you know, it was just as common as 1914. As it was 1984. I mean, it was basically a lynch mob was gathered there. And across the road, across Belvedere Street, was a group of about 50 to 75 people who were against the death penalty holding a candlelight vigil.
Linwood was asked whether he had any last words. "I am innocent," he said. Linwood Briley was pronounced dead shortly after 11 p.m., He became the second inmate in Virginia to be executed following the restoration of the death penalty. There would be 111 more to follow. His brother J.B. was next. He was executed on April 18, 1985. 3 years later, Earl Clanton was executed. Then, Wilbert Lee Evans, the death row inmate who protected Ethel Barksdale, the nurse who was held hostage during the escape, was executed in 1990. Derek Peterson's turn came in August 1991, and Willie Jones was executed in September 1992. Willie Turner, the weapons maker, was executed by lethal injection in May 1995. Lethal injection had become the preferred method of execution earlier that year. Dennis Stockton, the death row inmate who originally was going to be the driver during the escape, the one who dropped out and decided to take his chances with his appeal, was executed in September 1995. The last of the Mecklenburg Six to be executed was Lem Tuggle in December 1996. Before he died, he wished all the spectators a Merry Christmas. The only death row inmate from 1984 who is still alive is Joe Gerontano. Even though Virginia had abolished parole in 1995, incarcerated felons who were convicted prior to that year remained eligible. He was granted parole in November 2017. He is now reportedly a paralegal for a criminal law practice in Virginia. Joe Gerontano declined a request to be interviewed for this podcast. He stated in an email to Court Junkie that he no longer wants to revisit that part of his life. He also doesn't like to talk about the Brileys. Here again is Joe Jackson, who got to know Joe during his years of covering Virginia's death row.
I mean, he doesn't really want to be defined by this, and he realizes that he'll always be defined by this to a certain extent, but if he, you know, goes on TV or goes on a podcast, it's just going to remind people. And I don't think he wants to be defined by this.
It's believed by many who have analyzed the history of capital punishment in Virginia that the Briley brothers were the ones who ratcheted up support for it. Virginia used to be a very pro-death penalty state. In 1991, a Virginia Tech poll showed that 75% of Virginians supported the death penalty for premeditated murder. But the last execution in Virginia was in 2017. Virginia then completely abolished the death penalty in March 2021. Here's Virginia Governor Ralph Northam speaking to reporters after signing the bill.
Today, Virginia becomes the first southern state to end this practice. We join 22 other states in saying the government will not take a life. The government will no longer execute people. Now, make no mistake, if you commit the most serious of crimes, you will be punished. But Virginia can do that without continuing a system that gets it wrong even once. And a system that doesn't work the same for everyone who encounters it.
The death penalty remains legal in 27 states. The federal government also has a death row. And that's all for this episode. These episodes on the Briley brothers were researched and written by Tony Holt. A special thank you to Joe Jackson, Dale Brumfield, and Glenn Barber for helping us out with this episode. Joe Jackson is a former reporter for the Virginia Pilot and co-author of Dead Run, The Untold Story of Dennis Stockton and America's Only Mass Escape from Death Row. Dale Brumfield is a former journalist, author, and field director for Virginians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. And Glenn Barber is the chairman of the Mecklenburg, Virginia Board of Supervisors. Don't forget to follow Court Junkie on Instagram at Court Junkie, on Twitter at Court Junkie Pod, and on YouTube at youtube.com/Court Junkie. To hear these episodes without the ads or to check out additional bonus episodes, go to courtjunkie.com/support to see my Patreon options. Thanks again for listening. Until next time. 5G is here. But the big carriers want you to sign a pricey long-term contract to get in on it. Not anymore, because Straight Talk Wireless has rolled out 5G coverage nationwide, with plans starting at just $35 a month and no contract, all on America's best networks. Plus, get the latest smartphones from brands like Samsung, or you can bring your own phone and keep your number and 5G network just by swapping your SIM card. 5G coverage. 5G phones, less money. Straight Talk Wireless, no contract, no compromise. Available at Walmart and Walmart.com. 5G-capable device required. Actual availability, coverage, and speed may vary. Keep Your Own Phone requires a compatible, unlocked phone and Straight Talk KYOP kit. May need to change phone's APN settings.